Oh, this fucking wine is corked.
Is it really?
I think so. I'm like sensitive to cork taint. It could just be like
sensitive.
I'm sensitive to cork taint.
You're sensitive about taint.
My
I understand.
Taint is okay. Sensitive.
Now that was too much now. Now it's wrong.
Welcome, everyone.
Welcome
to You're Gonna Need a Bigger Bottle. It's a podcast about movies and wine. And I have no comment.
We are all in agreement. The show is primarily about movies, and it is also occasionally about wine.
Fuck you. For those people among you who don't know shit about one or both of those topics, my name is Jamie. I'm the wine guy.
He is Jamie. He is the wine guy. I am Scott. I am the movie guy, and we are here to help. Each episode, we pair a movie that I love with a wine that he loves.
We'll tell you and each other why we like them, how they're made, and why they work, if they do. Sometimes we find a pairing, sometimes we don't. Today, we...
We often find a pairing.
Hopefully, we find a pairing that works, sometimes we don't. Today, we continue with our lighthearted No Bummers miniseries. It's the end of the world as we know it. And I want wine.
At some point, one of us is going to have to sing the parody version of this on the show. But like, I don't know, like, I'm not like an REM person, you know? REM was like...
Yeah, REM was never like a thing that I...
Well, we were like a little bit too young. Like, I don't know, like I was old enough that I felt like I got to the fourth grade and they just issued me a copy of Nirvana's Nevermind. But like REM had kind of that, it felt like the moment passed by the time I discovered that there was music.
Yeah, I concur with that feeling.
Yeah,
we very much know that song.
Right. I know it from Independence Day. It's right. The song from Independence Day.
That's the most important thing. The most important lasting cultural impact of that song.
Right. Definitely anyway, just Independence Day. But it is the end of the world as we know it. And I and or Jamie wants wine. I kind of want wine now.
And I want wine.
Oh, there we go. We got to get some reverb on that. So today we are facing a doom that takes the form of a 400-foot-tall radioactive mutating dinosaur monster hell-bent on destroying Tokyo and punishing man for his follies. We are talking about 2016's Shin Godzilla. Giving Jamie a moment to interject here.
This movie kicks ass. It just kicks ass.
It's super good. Yeah, Shin Godzilla rules.
Obviously, I did the bad reviews game and we'll get there, but oh man, the bad reviews are just bad, bad, bad takes.
Oh boy. Oh, I'm super looking forward to hearing what people on the internet have to say about this movie. So Shin Godzilla 2016, written and directed by Hideaki Anno, who is the famed creator of the beloved anime Neon Genesis Evangelion. Shin is the first live-action Godzilla movie produced in Japan in 14 years. And like the 1954 original movie, it depicts the radioactive monster's first arrival in man's world. So this is the first real hard reboot in the, I think they're at 30 or 31 films now that Toho Studios has made, going back to the 1954 original, directed by Ishiro Honda. But this time it's told largely from the point of view of the politicians and the bureaucrats and the scientists who are responding to the deadly and terrifying crisis. There's plenty of the requisite smashing of buildings and blasting of helicopters, but even more thrilling are the montages, and I say montages plural, of conference rooms and command centers getting furnished, equipped, and staffed, and teams of people coming together to negotiate forever about what they're going to do. It is a full-blooded monster movie, and it's also a social commentary in the grand tradition of the series. It was the second highest grossing movie of 2016 in Japan. The highest grossing live-action movie in Japan, the highest grossing movie of the year, was Your Name, which made like twice as much money as this did and was a huge fucking hit in that country.
Pretty good movie, too.
I have never seen it.
It's good. I think you'd like it.
Shin Godzilla also won 6 awards at the Japan Academy Awards, which is like their film industry's equivalent of the American Oscars, among others, Best Picture and Best Director.
Wow.
Yeah. So huge honkin' hit. Critically beloved and acclaimed in Japan, it rules, and it is currently available wherever you rent your VOD movies. And I highly encourage you to do that because it's great. Like, Godzilla is just great on principle, but then this is like a very specific movie, and it is great in all of its own ways.
Word.
Jamie.
I dig it.
There is some kind of wine component to this episode, I'm told.
To most episodes, yes.
Mostly we just talk about Godzilla movies, but so you wanted to talk about wine today.
Is this going to be a podcast about Godzilla movies?
I mean, that would be pretty sweet.
There's got to be a podcast already about Godzilla
movies. I'm sure there are hundreds of them. Hundreds of them. There's like 50,000 new podcasts launched a year.
Jesus Christ, we are... Not even a drop in a bucket.
We are insignificant specks.
We might be the only wine and Godzilla podcast. Godzilla and wine, sorry.
Thank you. Godzilla and wine podcast. That does feel true, but I'm not going to make that assumption.
Right. With 50,000 new podcasts launched,
right.
Who the fuck knows?
Right.
So the wine that I chose today, coming from Trentino Alto Adige in Italy, up in the Dolomites, this is Foradori Teraldigo, vintage 2019. This is a wine that I have sold a ton of in my career. It's been featured on lists that I've run for years. The grape Teraldigo is going to be very unfamiliar for most people, and we'll get into the significance of it and it being planted in this place for sure. The estate is run by Elisabetta Foradori and her three children. Elisabetta has been hailed for a few decades as the queen of Teraldigo. There aren't a lot of really high quality producers of this grape in this area.
Which is called Teraldigo.
Teraldigo, okay. Yes. We're going to try and say the word Teraldigo as many times as possible during this episode.
Well, I feel like by the end of the episode, I would like to be able to pronounce it unhaltingly.
I would like that for you also.
Right.
So Elisabetta took this estate over from her father and in a series of gradually escalating moves, turned it from a bulk wine producing commercial winery into a much more artisanal, respectful of agriculture type winery, and has maintained sort of her reign as the Queen of Teraldigo all throughout, even as she changes the way things are done in the vineyard and the styles of the wines and the winemaking practices and all of that. I find her story very compelling. I find this wine very compelling. I think that, you know, from an area that's famous for Pinot Grigio, the like famously very neutral white wine that doesn't really taste like anything but gets you drunk. This is an example of something that is fuller bodied and blue fruit driven. This is very like blueberry, boysenberry, cassis, black cherry in its presentation. But it also has the sort of like the higher end, like lemongrass and tarragon kind of notes going on. There's something herbaceous about it.
You're just stealing all of my notes, Jamie. I was going to say that it had notes of tarragon and blubaciousness.
Good. Blubaciousness.
Is that not what you said?
That is not what I said.
It was in the ballpark.
Nope. I mean, I said herbaceousness, which is a word.
Herbaceousness, that seems like a word.
And blubaciousness, which is
not a word.
Not, but it's a full-bodied wine that has vibes similar to the Zinfandels that I really like. It's the kind of thing that I would unhaltingly put on a table and just assume everyone's going to like. There's nothing polarizing, I don't think, about this wine. A Cabernet drinker, as much as a Pinot drinker, as much as a Syrah drinker, would like this wine.
You don't think there's anything polarizing? You feel like all red wine drinkers would enjoy this?
Yes. I mean, unless all you drink is like funky, natty Beaujolais, then maybe you wouldn't like this. But even still, I think this wine hits on some of those notes as well. It's not quite so sanded down as her higher end bottlings. It's got a little bit of the rusticity that I associate with Beaujolais and with the Northern Rhone.
Rusticness?
Yes. Rusticity.
That can't possibly be how you conjugate that
word. You have a
word.
Laptop in your lap. Google it right now. Rusticity. It is a word.
The quality of being rustic or gauche.
Yep.
Well, Jamie, your rusticity is high, and I'm not referring to how rustic you are.
You think I'm gauche.
You're fucking gauche. That's right.
Of people in the world who have called me gauche, you have done it the most times.
I have never called you gauche before.
That is a fucking lie.
I've called you an asshole and a pig before. I don't think I've ever called you gauche.
You have absolutely called
me
gauche.
It's not really a word I use that often,
but
gauche.
I know specifically that you have used it in reference to me and specifically about how I dress.
I've said garish about the way that you dress.
You've definitely said garish. You've also said gauche. Don't try and deny it.
All right, Jamie. All right.
You say a lot of mean things to me, Scott.
Well, I mean, some people think that they're mean. I think it's being precise in the way that I use words to describe the phenomena that I see in front of me.
Fuck you, buddy. Let's move on.
So, Jamie, this is a movie that I had seen before, But you had never seen it before.
That is correct.
And off mic, you disclosed that you had never seen a Godzilla movie prior to this one, except for the horrible and appropriately hated 1998 Roland Emmerich directed American Godzilla.
That is
the
correct.
One with Matthew Broderick.
Thinking about that movie makes me want to make the like cat face when they smell their own pee.
Yeah. They're
like, you know, that's the emotion that movie gives me.
Right. But so having very little context for the character, for my beloved Big G.
Right.
What do you take from this movie? Because I think this was also my first ever Japanese Godzilla movie. I'm pretty sure.
Really?
I believe so. Yeah.
Yeah. You've been recently like just going through them.
Yeah. For my birthday last year, because it was fucking quarantine and because my wife was at work all day, my child and I were like, what are we going to do for Dad's birthday? And I'm like, this will be for you and it'll be for me. And we did an all day movie marathon. And one of the movies that I kind of smuggled in there for him was Destroy All Monsters, which is like, it's towards the later end of the initial Showa era 13 film cycle of Godzilla movies. It's directed by Ishiro Honda, who directed the original movie and then came back a bunch of times throughout the series. But it's just like, what if all of the monsters that we'd introduced as side characters throughout this series were all on one island at one time and they have to fucking fight aliens and King Ghidorah? And it's just like, it's wall-to-wall monsters and aliens, and my kid went apeshit for it. So in the year since then, we've been watching a lot. He's seen almost all of the original Showa era Godzilla movies that are on the beautiful Criterion box set right over there.
And he went for Halloween as Godzilla.
He was Godzilla for Halloween.
Which is super cool.
He thought it was great. And then when other people would see his costume and adults would be like, oh, Miles, that's such a cute Godzilla. And he would be like, no. It's awesome. It's not cute.
I love it. I love the whole thing. I've loved like talking to you about his like Godzilla experience and your Godzilla experience. Anyway, yeah, I've never seen any of the source material. Obviously, Godzilla is in the air, so to speak.
Yeah, like he's like a global pop culture icon.
Yeah, we're all conscious of Godzilla on some level. We know at the very least that Godzilla is a big monster that wrecks shit.
Yeah.
Some
he
of us
shit up.
Understand that he started as an allegory for the nuclear weapons.
Right.
But yeah, this was my first like real experience with a film. And I think not having the context hurt in some ways. Also the cultural context of like Japanese culture and then specifically the Godzilla stuff. However, this movie fucking rules. I love it. I had so much fun watching it. It's got a big monster. You know, I love big monsters.
And it's kind of three monsters.
Right.
Because he changes. So you get three flavors of Godzilla.
And there's a lot of destruction. Super cool monster fucking shit up. Love that. It also has this political bureaucratic side that has like weirdly West Wing vibes to it, which we've mentioned on this show before that we were West Wing boys. We loved that shit back in the day.
Yeah.
It hasn't aged as well as I think either of us would like it to have.
No, it hasn't. No.
It makes me sad.
Yeah.
But, you know, we move on into the future.
We do.
We do.
We can take the things of childhood into adulthood as long as we recognize that they come from a place of childlike naivete.
That's right.
Yeah. The West Wing was a cutting edge political drama in the late 90s, and now it's a science fiction fantasy series. With characters and whose motivations do not resemble the real world in any way. It's closer to Star Trek than it is to like contemporary America.
That is going to resonate with me for the next couple of days.
Yeah,
Fuck you for that, buddy.
It's an egalitarian utopia where good people working together can actually make a change for the betterment of people's lives in America.
We're going to move right the fuck along. Because also that's the vibe of this movie. Like a small group of dedicated people can change the world. The offshoot branch of politicians and bureaucrats and scientists that work outside of the traditional system, get it the fuck done and save the day. Spoilers, the day is saved.
Yeah, but they're only able to do it because of the extreme ineffectiveness and inefficiency of the existing government, which is basically destroyed because of its own failure to act quickly.
Right. It's complex.
Yeah.
There is a lot to it.
Is there like a favorite scene or like a moment that really stands out to you? Like what is there a particular moment or gag that really resonates with you?
This is going to sound silly, and I don't 100% know why this is the thing that resonates with me when you ask that question, but it's the thing that popped right into my head.
Okay. Okay.
Right in the beginning, when evacuations are starting and people are going underground, there's the like news footage shot of the them going down the slide and the woman like gleefully.
Yeah. It's a slide. She goes down the slide with great joy and gusto.
Yeah. Yes.
That's your favorite part?
I loved it.
I mean, it's the only joy in the movie. Like, there's a lot of entertainment and a lot of thrills in the movie, and there's humor, but it's the only time a character is experiencing joy.
That is correct.
Even Godzilla doesn't seem to really enjoy destroying Tokyo that much. No.
No, Godzilla's not having a good time.
No.
It seems like it hurts to evolve the way that Godzilla is evolving.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. It does seem agonizing to have your genetically superior body continue to change in real time.
It's not a comfortable experience, I don't think.
No.
Nor is, you know, being Japanese and watching your crown jewel city be destroyed.
Yeah, slowly.
And due to the inaction of the people in charge.
Yeah.
That moment for what, because I love joy and irreverence and all like whimsy, it was like this, something horrible is happening. And this woman is excited about going down a slide. And I just love that.
Pretty cool. Going down a slide in a stairwell, I think. It was like a fast evacuation tunnel that they put in a stairwell. Yeah. Not what I expected, but okay.
What about you? What's the thing that got you?
I mean, just as like somebody who is, and I'm not like an expert on the Godzilla movies. Like I've seen the canonical, like the first 13. I've seen some of the classics. I haven't seen anything from like any of the Japanese films from the mid 80s to the modern day. And I've seen like all of the American Godzilla movies, but like it does things that are different. And as somebody who like rewatching it now, but like as I've been very enmeshed in like old school Godzilla movies as a genre in the last year, it was just exciting seeing like different things happening. So like when he drops the super breath for the first time, and it's like a flamethrower, and then the bottom jaw unhinges, and then it hones down
focuses into a laser.
Yeah, like a purple atomic laser that he just cuts all of the buildings in half with. Like it is both a phenomenal visual and also very distressing.
It's a great reveal.
It is the most, well, it's an amazing reveal, right? Like they know how to play with the iconography in this movie, and you're waiting the whole time like, oh shit, he's full on bipedal Godzilla now. Like when's he dropping that atomic super breath?
Right.
And it comes out in this radically different way. And then it is more destructive. Like the hardcore Godzilla fans, they've mapped all of this shit out, right? So like they know that this movie came out in 2016. In 2017, the American legendary produced Godzilla King of the Monsters came out. And they know that for a year, Shin Godzilla was the tallest version of Godzilla ever to exist on screen. He is 189 meters tall. No, 118 meters tall, 389 feet high. But then when the American one came out the next year, I don't know if it was some act of one-upsmanship, but he's like a meter taller.
You've got to be kidding.
Yeah. Even though it's the same Godzilla from the previous American movie, like 3 or 4 years prior. But whatever, that's fine. But yeah, the hardcore fans have paid attention to like the minutiae of this so much that they had mapped out that Godzilla's super breath attack that like irradiates and lays waste to like a huge section of Tokyo is the single most destructive singular event that ever happened in a Godzilla movie.
Really?
Like that he is more destructive than any version of Godzilla ever before. And that it's really just like the amount of radiation that he's putting out, but that his super breath is more destructive than anybody else's ever.
That's super cool.
And then he's got the purple like anti-aircraft lasers just shooting out of his back spikes, which is also a amazing visual that is very distressing to look at. I don't know why. Just something about like bright fucking purple, you know, Terminator lights, like lasers shooting up in the sky over a city.
I thought it was super fucking cool. I was not distressed at all. It's all cool. It was just cool.
It's all cool, but I found it disturbing. So this is one of the things that I find so interesting about the movie is the way that it remixes Godzilla. It is a hard reboot, even whenever they would have softer reboots in the earlier eras of the Toho Films productions, there was always some continuity. Like it was never the first time Godzilla was emerging before. Whereas in America, every time we make a new movie with anything, it's got to be a reboot now. they're doing something different from the beginning. Their vision of Godzilla is radically different from what we've seen before. He evolves. Like, he starts out as this like amphibian aquatic creature who breathes by gills.
And they're so sure because he has gills that he can't go on land.
Right. And one of many instances where their hubris is proven to be their undoing, because he is ultimately able, because he can evolve in real time. But so he changes. Like, Godzilla had never really changed before. Like, the Godzilla, at least in the first 13 movies that I had seen, like, he doesn't really go through evolutions. He gets a new power once in a while, but then that power is kind of swept under the rug. Like, he is able to make himself an electromagnet, or he's able to electromagnify himself and then use, like, magnetic powers in the, it's not Terror of Mechagodzilla. I think it's just Godzilla versus Mechagodzilla, whichever one is the first Mechagodzilla movie. But yeah, this Godzilla evolves. We get a sense of the life cycle. We get a sense of the biology and just how alien the creature is. And then when he takes on his final form, it is more terrifying and more destructive since any version since the original, right? Like, this movie goes back to the roots of the franchise. Hideaki Anno, when he was first offered the job, he turned it down.
Why?
Well, because his response was like, the first movie is perfect and it's a masterpiece, and I don't want to do it if I can't at least reach that level. And so they offered it to him again and again, and he finally agreed. But his take was going to be, it has to be a reboot. We have to start fresh, because I don't want to do what happened with Godzilla over the decades. So, like, the first two movies, he's a metaphor for the bomb, right? Like, he's irradiated everywhere. He is created as a result of underwater or underground H-bomb testing. And so, and it's, the first movie is 1954. It's 9 years after Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It's
fucking intense.
Yeah, it is a very recent cultural trauma that they're unpacking with those movies. And then as the series goes on, the people at Toho realize, like, well, this is a franchise now, and he needs to be a hero, essentially. Like, we need to sell toys, but also, like, we need the audience to be invested. So that's where the rest of the kaiju start getting introduced.
Right.
More like, you've got your Mothra and your Mechagodzilla and your Gigan and all these other creatures that get introduced to give Godzilla someone to fight against. By, like, five movies into the series, he is no longer a malevolent metaphor for the bomb. He has essentially become a mascot for Japan. He doesn't come out to defend Japan. And when he shows up, like, the defense forces still get ready and they do all the evacuations. But, like, a couple movies into the series, he's not stomping on buildings because he's angry and he hates humanity. He is accidentally knocking buildings over on his way to go kill the monster that is way worse.
Right.
The series pretty quickly turned into, instead of Godzilla being a metaphor for the bomb, Godzilla fought against alien or external threats.
And that is a result of Godzilla's popularity? Like, something so popular has to then become something that we cheer for?
It has to be something that you cheer for. And you see it in, you know, like, a lot of American movies right now. You just look at, like, the Fast and Furious movies, and they keep taking people who are villains or antagonists, but then they're characters who pop and are popular, and so we have to find a way to make them become part of the team.
Right.
It's just a way of, like, capitalizing on the thing that the audience is invested in. But, like, at a certain point, the audience just won't root for the bad guy anymore. But so, yeah, he goes from being this H-bomb metaphor to being the guy who is defending Japan from outside influences. I think it's Godzilla versus Mothra. The big enemy is actually a Western, it might even specifically be an American or a European corporation that is trying to take possession of Mothra's egg because it landed on property where they were developing something. And then as the series goes on, it's always aliens. Like, it's always Godzilla fighting off aliens who are secretly inserting themselves into Japanese society and taking over politics, or they're taking over, like, culture, right?
Right.
And so it's, like, very much like the cultural nationalism of Japan is defended by this, like, this mascot. He becomes an icon. And this movie says, fuck all that noise. Like, we're not doing any of that. The explicit impetus for the movie was the Fukushima disaster, the triple disaster of earthquake, tsunami, and then nuclear power plant meltdown. The American movies make Godzilla a force of nature, right? Like, they right. can't tackle the political ramifications of it, and they certainly can't deal with Godzilla is a thing that is created by American, like, militaristic folly using the bomb, right?
Right.
It's not like revenge for the bomb. It can't be that here. So he's a force of nature. He's a geological or like a meteorological phenomenon, essentially. This movie is all of it. Shin Godzilla is the bomb, and he is a force of nature, right? So he's the power plant melting down, but he's also the waterways flooding in and bringing all the boats like crashing onto shore. Like it's very much about climate and about weather. And he's a rallying cry for nationalism. Hideaki Anno appears to be synthesizing all of these different like allegorical modes of Godzilla into one vision, which is, yes, he's an atomic terror. Yes, he is a force of nature. And he can be a rallying cry for cultural nationalism, because ultimately, like you were saying, like a dedicated group of hardworking Japanese civil servants are the only ones who are able to save the country. Because if they asked anybody else to do it, the immediate solution from the Americans and from the UN is like, ah, fuck it, let's nuke Tokyo.
Yeah, all right.
I was going to challenge you on the
nationalism part, but that being the answer from the rest of the world, you're not wrong.
It's funny because the politics of the movie are like surprisingly, right? Like you have the initial prime minister is not particularly engaged, but he is listening to everyone and he's trying to follow the right guidance, but they just move so slowly. They just keep having to change conference rooms and set up new command posts.
It also, interestingly, goes through different phases of political difficulty. I was worried a little bit in the beginning because they go really hard on the inefficiency of the politicians, right? They're constantly changing venue, even though the same people are in the room. You know, I move that we have to adjourn this to go have a proper cabinet meeting, but then it's a less formal meeting in the residence or whatever, and then to another place and another, and they're obviously wasting a huge amount of time.
It's the failings of having career middle management. People who just have to justify their existence.
Right. Then there's a point where it seems like the major problem is the prime minister's lack of action. He continues to get asked to give an order and doesn't. And then when he does, it takes too long and then destruction ensues and he dies.
Yeah. And yeah, like the entire cabinet is basically wiped out.
Right.
And then only our heroic band of intrepid outside of box thinkers.
And that's the last phase. There is a new government, but it's so ineffectual, our intrepid band of heroes can just sidestep everything.
They basically get to skip all the red tape because everything's in disarray.
I just think it's interesting. When I said earlier that I had trepidation when they were going so hard in the beginning, I was worried that the movie was just going to be this gag.
It's
going to
be super one note. Yeah.
And it has these phases that are super fucking interesting and compelling and show you a different side of what the problem is. The problem isn't just bureaucracy and middle management. It's also the paralysis of a leader who's not ready to do this damn thing.
Yeah.
And then it's also the fallback plan, which is inadequate.
Yeah, and I mean, this is something I was thinking watching it again the other night, is that I found myself surprisingly sympathetic to that first prime minister for how overwhelmed he is. Like, he'll basically have, like, there's a couple moments where he'll have three or four people shouting different plans or options to him, and then he has to make a decision. And he'll have a moment where he's like, what? And then somebody will say, come on, sir, you have to make a decision right now. And he's like, he hesitates, and then maybe he finally pulls the trigger.
See, I had the exact opposite reaction to him and his, and like, I'm very sympathetic to basically everyone else in the movie.
Yeah.
I think he's the one that just personally fucks up. Like, man, you're the prime minister and you have ostensibly the most qualified people in the country giving
advising
you
him.
Exactly. Pick a fucking option and go.
Well, I mean, but sometimes he picks an option and it's the wrong one. So what made me sympathetic to him, and this is something we talked about a little bit before, is that especially the first half hour, but the movie overall is like this multimedia collage onslaught of data, right? So like, in addition to, we have just like your cinema footage, like the stuff that the movie cameras are capturing, but then you've got CCTV footage and you've got social media feeds and you've got very authentic news feeds, something that it's just so often that movies get wrong where like news just doesn't look like news at all. Like it really looks authentic, like news response to a disaster. You get like the footage from the Coast Guard guys who go out on the first boat in the beginning where the thing first emerges.
That's a cool sequence. Yeah. Anyway, go on.
But you have all of that and then you are constantly being given super titles. So like for an English language audience watching the movie, not only am I reading subtitles from the constant dialogue, almost all of which is exposition of a very technical and jargon heavy nature, and that's at the bottom of the screen. And then at the top of the screen, you get the super titles of this is the location, this is the room that we're in, this is the meeting that is happening, this is the person and what their job is constantly. I'm a little bit sympathetic to the prime minister. I'm just watching the fucking movie version of it and I am having trouble retaining all of the data.
Yeah.
And like, he's just being bombarded with it. Like, I think it's a meta-textual way for the movie to try and give you a little bit of empathy to like, yes, these institutions are not strong and we don't, in this scenario, we don't have the right people in all the right places, especially at the top, but also like, Jesus, what an impossible fucking job to have, you know, to be crisis response management to something like that. Like, it's terrifying and it's not to absolve them or forgive them for their failings. And I don't think the movie is like, absolving any of the failings of the Japanese government's response to the Fukushima disaster.
Not.
But I think it is depicted with more empathy than you might think when you hear that it's like a social satire of like a political or a disaster scenario.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah, specifically for the prime minister. Like everyone else is in an impossible situation. And he is too, but like your one job is to make a decision. Right or wrong.
That's a pretty big job. It's a huge job.
Maybe you
shouldn't have run for that office.
That's the thing.
I feel like that should be a question that everyone gets asked. Anyone who ever has to run for office, ever, you have to be asked the question, what do you do in a Godzilla situation? And if you don't have an answer for it, then you haven't thought hard enough about the job that you are interviewing for.
Pop quiz, hotshot.
Yeah.
A nuclear lizard comes out of the ocean and begins wrecking your nation's largest city.
That's right.
What do you do?
Well,
what do you do?
Well, you evacuate the shit out of everyone immediately.
Yes.
And you start scouring the earth for other giant monsters to fight back against it.
That really is, yeah, that's the way of things.
It is the recurring theme that my child independently on his own realized like two Godzilla movies in. He was like, Daddy, why are they getting out the army and the helicopters and the attack jets and the tanks? They never work. You can only fight the monsters with another monster. I'm like, I know, buddy. They just don't get it. He's like, they don't get it. You just need another monster.
The Pacific Rim people got it. They built giant monsters.
Build monsters to fight monsters.
That's right.
Pacific Rim also apparently heavily influenced by Neon Genesis Evangelion.
Yes.
Yeah.
I have heard that, but never seen that show.
I have seen.
You watched two of the films.
I've watched two of the films. Of the many movies. I watched one version of the Neon Genesis Evangelion Regenesis Death parentheses true and parentheses squared, which is like the remake of the highlights reel of the 26 episode series.
That's either a very bad title or you did bad at saying the title.
It's not good. And it was very convoluted and I was utterly mystified by that film. And then I watched the second one, which is like a redo of the ending of the series. And while it is more of a conventional narrative and not just a clip show of 90 minutes of previously on, it was also very confounding and strange. And I think I'm just going to have to watch the show because it's compelling and it's fucking weird. Oh, it's so fucking weird.
I'm very interested. And so many people are like, it is canonized into the realm of the greats when it comes to anime. I feel like I should watch it.
It's a hell of a thing.
So Scott, I want to talk about something specific about this movie and then also more broadly, which is the subs versus dubs. I don't know that there's a debate. I think everyone kind of is agreed that subs are better.
I would say right-thinking people are, and
right.
Then other people will just complain when a dub is not available, or why don't they just speak English?
Right.
Right.
Yes, we all agree that subs are superior. However, What's your little like?
It's fine. We don't all agree to it.
Many people, it is agreed by the cognoscenti.
Let's say conventional wisdom.
Conventional wisdom would have us believe, yes.
That subs are better. Yeah.
But it was sort of brought home to me as I was watching this movie in particular. I'm never bothered by watching subs, but there is a lot of information in this movie. There's a lot of quick cuts. There's a lot of dialogue to read. And as you mentioned, there's a fair bit of super text to read. So I found myself pausing a bunch and having difficulty viewing the image and appreciating the visuals of the movie.
Yeah.
And that's a thing that I've heard from people who prefer dubs, is that they are slow readers or have difficulty in that way somehow. And just it takes them out of the movie.
Yeah.
And I think that that's a valid complaint.
I think it's valid.
What are your thoughts on this?
Well, so I mean, like, if you're going to be a purist and if you're going to be a person who wants to see movies in other languages, then you should watch it in the original language. Is what my traditionalist purist point of view might say. And I almost never watch anything with a dub track. But for this movie, for example, yes, visually it is a much cleaner and more uncluttered experience to not have a fuck ton of text at the top of your screen and a fuck ton of text at the bottom of your screen. It is overwhelming. As I told you, I gave up on the super titles. So in our home theater, I have like a black felt mask that can come down when it's like a super widescreen movie like this is. And I just brought in the masking on the top and I just couldn't see the super titles anymore. Because after 20 minutes, I was like, all right, I get it. I get what you're going for. You're bombarding me and overwhelming me with information. I get it. I'm not going to retain any of it. So now it's just distracting. And I blocked it out, which I was able to do. The problem is, because on the Blu-ray, they include the dub track. And I put it on for like 2 minutes just to see after you told me about your renting issue where they made the...
They made them separate movies on Amazon VOD. So if you're renting VOD from Amazon, make sure it says the original Japanese version.
Right. That's confounding. But I put on the dub track the other night and it's a terrible fucking dub. Like, it's bad.
It is.
That's the big slight against dubs. It's not just a purity thing. Like, many dubs have very, very bad vocal performances. There are a lot of dubs that have very good vocal performances. Like the Reliable Standby, and this is like a big part of our household with watching things with my kid, the Miyazaki movies, especially once Disney started being their distributor in the US, for all of my many faults with that company, they got...
You have faults with Disney? That's I've never heard of this. This is a new...
Stop it. They always got phenomenal talent for their... English language dubs of Miyazaki films. I will say, like, for people who would make the complaint, whether it was at my old job at the festival or just, you know, people I would talk to about the difficulty of reading subtitles, like, yeah, it used to be hard for me to read subtitles and watch the movie as well. I got used to it. And now in my brain, when I watch a subtitled movie and I think back on it later and like I'm thinking about dialogue, I will see the actor and I will hear their voice, but in my brain, I'm hearing the English. I'm hearing what I read. Like, your brain is just able to transpose it, but it's like any muscle. You just need to exercise it. But yeah, I don't think there's any like one pro or con in favor of it. It's just like, it's every movie is going to be a different situation and you have to figure out what's going to be most comfortable for you. If it's a barrier for you to experience the rest of the movie, then like, yeah, watch the dub track. But like, just be forewarned because it might be garbage. It might be really badly acted.
The dub track is a barrier in and of itself.
Yeah.
I accidentally started Squid Game on the dub track.
Yeah.
And I was not pleased.
There's a fine line to walk between subtitling for accuracy, right? So like a literal translation of everything that's said.
Right.
But then you also have to account for things that do not translate easily, like specific cultural idioms or things that don't cross over borders. And then you have to just worry about clarity. Like, it needs to be short enough so that people can read it quickly without missing all of the image that's on screen. And there's been a lot of back and forth in terms of like how that one is accurately representing that show and what the substance of it is about.
Wish I knew Korean, then I'd be able to have an opinion.
Yeah, but then there's other people who are saying, well, no, like, it's actually a very elegant way to translate it. And there's, you know, American, like, Korean speakers who are going back and forth. And it's a whole conversation.
Right.
I heard a great anecdote about subtitling recently, and it was from Edgar Wright. He was on Brett Goldstein's podcast. Brett Goldstein, who is one of the writers, and he plays fucking Roy Kent on Ted Lasso. And he has this podcast where he asks people like questions about movies and like basically tell me the story of your life through personal movie experiences, right? And he had this super long Edgar Wright interview, but they were talking about subtitling. And Wright said that he was doing the press tour for Scott Pilgrim. And I think it was right after the world premiere of Scott Pilgrim. And he remembered being in the audience and or being in the theater, and the audience was confounded by the movie. Like, it's a wordy movie. It's very talky.
Yep.
And there's a lot of jokes in the dialogue, but it's also visually so hyperkinetic and so stimulating that it was like too much and people just couldn't process it. Not only are the jokes not landing, but then like it's a barrier to engagement with the movie. I guess it was the next time he did like a big action movie was Baby Driver. And he was very particular when writing it that he was like, I'm going to strip down all the dialogue because I want it to be very simple so that people all around the world are not going to be flummoxed by this movie because I just can't help but make my characters too talky.
That's cool.
Yeah.
I like that.
So yeah, I don't have a good answer for you.
That is a good answer. I disagree. But I think you have a good answer.
But it's not an answer. It's like, it's, you know.
There isn't.
Find the thing that works for you, right, audience member.
Which is a good answer.
All right, fine.
I think.
I concur.
And beware of, because the performance thing is real.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's a reason why, like, there's, you know, even if you've never seen a Godzilla movie before, you know that the thing about Godzilla movies is, like, guys in rubber monster suits fighting each other in slow motion and then, like, cut to an all-Japanese cast dubbed over with a terrible fucking English language dub track.
Right.
And that is 100% true for all of those dub tracks that I've seen. You gotta get lucky, you know?
Yeah.
If you're going for the dub route.
The next thing that we got to talk about is how this movie fits into this miniseries that you have brought us into in an effort to not be devastating, but discussing the end of the world.
Well, it's not that I'm an apocalyptic person, Jamie. I just feel the walls closing in. You know what I'm saying?
It's not that you're apocalyptic. It's that you see the apocalypse on the horizon.
That's a loaded word. All right. Don't put that in my mouth. I did say apocalyptic.
You did.
But yeah, how does Shin Godzilla fit into It's the End of the World as We Know It? And Jamie and or I Want
and
Wine?
I Want Wine.
Oh boy, this was a mistake. I should have anticipated this. So, I mean, we talked about this, about the political murkiness, and this is probably just that we're, you know, fucking white gaijin talking out of our asses, not knowing what we're talking about. But I think it is interesting that he has a complex series of seemingly contradictory things to say about our governments and how they respond to crises. To me, a lot of the first half of the movie, up until like Godzilla goes full nuclear with his purple super breath and, you know, kills the whole government, and only then is our undersecretary or under subminister or whatever, Yaguchi, are essentially our main character, is he able to like step up and think outside the box and do things right, however they want to. But like up until that point, the movie reminds me a lot of Starship Troopers, which is a movie that itself is like an unwinking satire of propaganda. Like Starship Troopers is the propaganda that government would have made about the war against the bugs.
Right.
And the first half of this movie to me at times feels very much like a little bit propagandist and satiric. But then the second half is really where it leans into like there's a sincerity and there's an earnestness, and we stop being critical of the government and of their actions because suddenly they're able to be effective. It's borderline advocating like fascism. You know, it's
almost, yeah.
You wipe the slate clean and like democracy doesn't work. And now that we're able to like sidestep all the institutions, like then only are these capable, active, unconventional thinkers able to like fix things. I don't know. He's got a lot to say, and I don't know that I'm unpacking all of it correctly. This movie is very much like of a piece for me with Dr. Strangelove, which we talked about last time. They're both movies about how our most critical government institutions, the ones that we depend upon in times of great danger, are entirely dependent upon having the right personnel in the right places at the right times. It's refreshing, and it reflects the world that I think we're all currently very much living in. And it's also very distressing.
Yeah, because we've felt the weight of not having the right people in the right place at the right time.
And not just not the right people, but very much the wrong people.
Incredibly the wrong people.
Yeah.
The wrong person.
Just the worst. Can I give you a terrible thought experiment?
Please do.
Oh,
go on ahead and hurt me.
Just imagine, change nothing from the last 20 months. All right. You can go back in time. And the only thing that you're going to change nothing else about the man, his politics, his policies, anything else. But you just change the fact that isn't afraid to look like a pussy wearing a mask? Like, what if he just came out on like day one and was pro mask and wasn't skeptical and wasn't cowardly and fear mongering about all of it? How many of those 750,000 people would still be alive today?
I hate you for this.
You're welcome. The other thing I was going to say, and maybe if this is good, I'll dub it back into the previous episode. General Jack D. Ripper.
Yes.
Fucking QAnon. He is straight up a QAnon guy.
That is 100% true.
Yeah. So
yeah, that is factual.
Just when you go to bed tonight, just remember that there's still people in that exact same job. And that, you know, some of them probably think that we got to stop the steal, Jamie.
They're trying to sap and purify our precious bodily fluids, Scott.
That's no less ridiculous than we have to stop a secret cult of shadow government Satanists from raping children.
I know. That's why I was darkly laughing about it.
Okay, I'm just checking.
Because it hurts.
Your precious bodily fluids, Jamie. I can't help you with them.
My bodily fluids are precious, Scott.
They are very impurified as well.
I can't argue that.
Yep.
I can't argue it at Jamie, all. Need another drink.
So yeah, that's how I feel about this movie and the end of the world. It's just like with Dr. Strangelove.
I find the take a lot more complicated than Dr. Strangelove in all the ways that you described. Dr. Strangelove is easier because you're so fixated on these characters, on Merkin Muffley and Buck Turgidson and Jack D. Ripper and Lionel Mandrake, and they are mockeries of themselves. And in Shin Godzilla, they're nobody.
There's almost no characters in the movie.
Right.
It's not really about individuals.
It's
all.
Not. Yoguchi and what's her name?
The American envoy.
Yes.
Yeah. Who is like a Japanese national, but she is an American envoy or something like that. Yeah.
And she's supposedly like she has aspirations of being the president by age 40, but her grandmother's homeland was Japan and she has strong feelings about that or whatever. They're the only characters, really.
Yeah.
You get the prime minister, you get the second prime minister, and then you get Godzilla. And then a couple of shots, you get the one shot of the American president basically saying, it sucks, but we've got to nuke them.
What else can we possibly do? I love that line where the prime minister has just gotten off the phone with, I don't know, the president or the secretary general. And he's explaining to everybody that like, yeah, they're gonna nuke Tokyo the moment this thing starts showing activity again. And everyone's incensed and outraged. And he's like, they said if it was New York, they'd do the exact same thing.
Oh my God.
And the person telling him that sincerely believes it. And it is entirely up to the audience as to whether or not you think that's actually true. I feel like maybe if it was New York or if it was London, despite what contemporary disaster movies and superhero movies might show us now, where those cities are fucking obliterated on a biweekly basis. But like, I feel like they might have pulled out all the stops before going to, you know, B-2 stealth bomber fucking dropping shit.
It's bleak. It's tough. But it kind of kicks ass.
Oh, it definitely kicks ass. Although I am distressed that you found it as like righteously awesome as you did. Because for me, it's very much akin to like the 54, the Honda, the first Godzilla.
It's enjoyable to watch. Yeah, that's my thing.
But he's I don't know, all the devastation and all the destruction and like you get all that gushing blood like from his gills. Like it's foreshadowing the huge fucking body count. Like I found it distressing. Huh. Yeah, as unsettling as a giant kaiju movie could be, despite my great love of huge monsters destroying things.
I
found it distressing.
I can see that, and the level of destruction is high. But I was, most of the time, despite it being pretty heavy, I was just having fun.
As long as you had a good time.
I had a good time, Scott.
Well, Jamie, I'm going to guess that there are some people on the internet who did not have a good time.
There are a few people on the internet had a bad time. It's time, everyone, for Scott's favorite game, Bad Reviews. It's a game where I read bad user reviews from the internet, and Scott has to figure out if they are about the wine or about the movie, while also remaining intact as a human.
I really am just Daffy Duck. Every game that I've come up with for the show has been to antagonize you, and you just love attention, and all press is good press, and you don't care. And then you come up with a game for me that is just about antagonizing me, and I am antagonized by the premise of the game, and then also by the substance every time.
Scott, our dynamic has always been Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck.
I know that, but I don't you know, have confused sexual feelings when you dress up like a lady.
I think you do. I've seen the way you look at me.
They're not confused.
Okay.
They are confused when Bugs Bunny dresses up like a lady.
Before we start the game, I want to begin just by noting one of the themes across bad reviews of Shin Godzilla. Plenty of people were quick to note that if you replace the N in Shin Godzilla with a T, that it becomes a more appropriate in their eyes.
Ooh. All right, great. Title. So this is what we're going
that
for.
That was a theme. I saw probably 12 to 16 reviews that began exactly that way.
Shit, Godzilla.
Yep.
Wow. Okay. Lay it on me, Jamie.
Here we go. Oh, dear. Whoever is scoring this redacted above a 1 score is clearly in need of hospitalization.
That sounds like it's of the wine.
That is of the movie.
Who says whoever is scoring this movie above a 1 score? That's just not any kind of movie grading nomenclature I've heard before.
Well, I mean, this is IMDb and it's on a 1 to 10 scale.
But they said 1 score?
Yeah. By Maka 00955. Written in 2017 on IMDb. This person goes on to say a lot of things, including that the monster looks like a barbecued squirrel in his first phase.
I don't disagree with that. I think part of what makes the monster so cool in this movie is that he looks fucking weird.
I agree with that. There's a lot in this review, but the last part, I just think his last line, which ends in an exclamation point, is, "I'll never look at spiky poo in the same way again."
Well. All right, that's fine. Maka 6583, whatever.
Okay. Next up. Disappointing. Started out poor and didn't improve much. No redeeming features.
How is poor spelled?
P-O-O-R.
All right, I thought maybe there was a hint there in the spelling. I feel like I'm allowed to ask you how
you
they're
are.
Spelled.
You absolutely are.
I'm going to guess wine. It's about the wine.
This is about the wine. This is Joanna Pulicino on Vivino, 1 star.
1 star. It started out poor.
It didn't improve much. And I disagree. I think the longer it's open, the more expressive it becomes.
I concur. Yeah. I had a glass when we first opened it the other night and then immediately hyperactively decanted it. And it was like, oh, flavor. Great. This is much better. Yeah.
Okay. Next up. Boring. No character.
Character. Singular.
Singular.
That has to be the wine.
That is the wine, correct.
All right. Context clues.
User Sachi on Vivino, 1 star.
That said, if somebody said this movie had no characters, I would struggle to disagree with them.
Which
is kind of the point. It is. It's kind of the point.
Okay. WTF is this crap in Terabang? What drugs are you all on that you gave it above a 1 rating? What a joke.
So this is for the movie, but also, what is an interrobang again? Is that the upside down exclamation point?
Interrobang is exclamation point question mark.
I forgot that had a name, yep. Interrobang. And this is movie. This is movie.
Yeah, this is movie. Dragon 35375 on IMDb.
IMDb.
IMDb has proven to be a source of very interesting bad reviews.
Are they interesting?
They at least make me laugh. And one honorable mention.
Okay, good.
This is a good review. This is 4.5 stars Letterboxd.
Damn right.
Aaron Wimmer.
Bring it, Letterboxd.
Godzilla, stomp on me.
That's pretty good. That's pretty good.
4.5 stars.
4.5 stars. Out of that was Letterboxd, so that's five. Yeah. That is my rating for this movie as well. Yep. 4.5 stars.
Well done, Scotty. You got all four.
Did I get all four?
You got all four.
All right. I did it.
You did the damn thing.
I did it. I survived bad reviews.
All right. It's wine time.
It is wine time. It's wine o'clock.
Scotty, what did you think of this wine?
It's a quarter past wine.
I lerve this wine. What do you think?
I don't lerve it.
You don't lerve it.
I don't lerve it. I will admit I've had it and it's tasted different every time I've had some. I opened a bottle a couple of nights ago. We had it with a ramen. My first glass, I was not crazy about. My second glass was decanted. And I was getting a lot more fruit adjacent flavors and smells and things in the ballpark of sweetness. And then I had a glass this morning before you got here because I had not written down my notes the other night and I wanted to refresh. And then we're pretty sure that had just gone off.
Yeah, that
did not taste right. And now this tastes like a totally different beast altogether. So I don't know.
So give me what notes you have.
My strongest impressions. my strongest impressions was getting fresh cream on the nose.
Okay.
Like almost like sour cream. But you know, the way that like or like somewhere between like heavy cream and buttermilk, you know?
Creme fraiche.
Creme fraiche.
Creme fraiche.
That's right. And on the taste, I was getting blueberries.
Oh, yeah.
I was getting some strong blueberry vibes. Is this the highest bodied thing we've drank so far? Because this is like,
this might be,
this is like syrup out of the glass.
This is a full body. This is a big boy.
That's what a big boy is. A big boy is full body. Very, very high in the body. And then it's highly tannic, right? It's got the mega tannins.
It's not hugely tannic, I don't think.
Sometimes I can't tell the difference between tannin and acid. My mouth just knows. Don't likey. Too much. Tone it down.
The tannins like run down the middle of your tongue, but they're not too strong. And then they sort of, they vanish as the acid fills your mouth with saliva.
So this is a higher acid. Is the acidity akin to citrus? Because I was getting some citrusy notes as well.
It can be sometimes.
Something like lemon juice almost.
Yeah. I mentioned in the beginning that I think this has a lemongrass kind of aroma to it.
Well, that's not the same as citrus though, right? Lemongrass is an herb.
But lemongrass smells like lemon. It's just the herbaceous side of things. I'm saying I agree with you. I would specifically put it at lemongrass as opposed to lemon juice, because lemon juice does have a particular smell to me. But if you get lemon juice, I'm not going to argue with you.
What else? What else are you getting? What else is your more highly developed palate and or nose detecting?
Blueberries, dried black currants, black cherries. I get like red plum. I thought earlier that I was getting some prune on this wine, but it's sort of...
No, I'm feeling prune.
But the lemongrass thing, for sure, that's sort of higher toned, maybe like an orange blossom. There's some kind of a florality to it. Maybe violets. It's mostly fruit driven, but then it's herbal and floral as well.
Herbal and floral, even though there are no herbs nor flora in this wine.
Earlier I said tarragon.
Is there tarragon in the wine?
No.
But just the flavor of tarragon.
Right. We've been over this. We're past the point where we think that there are herbs in the wine, right?
All right, fine. So there's tarragon. Which one is tarragon again?
Tarragon's the one that is sort of in the star anise licorice realm.
Oh, fuck. I just bought some the other day because I knew we were out of it in the herb cabinet. And I'm probably not going to use that.
It's good. Oh, well. It's really good with seafood.
With seafood?
Really good with seafood, citrus, those sorts of flavor profiles. You do like a tarragon butter with lobster, chef's kiss.
Mm.
But that would not be a good pair with this wine.
You don't think lobster would go well with this wine?
I don't. I generally don't love seafood and specifically shellfish with red wine, and definitely not a red wine that is this full-bodied.
Why?
Tannins don't generally agree with seafood. There's just like that astringency makes the seafood taste more metallic than delicious fish. That being said, like if you like it, do it. One time I had a guest at Micah. We were doing an oyster tasting, four courses of different preparations of oysters. Dude came in by himself, got an oyster tasting and a bottle of Barolo, one of the most tannic wines that you can possibly order. And that sounded horrible to me. But he was happy as a pig in shit. And who am I to tell him? Chinese business people, wealthy Chinese business people, will go into American restaurants and order big tannic red wine with their like raw seafood. And it seems weird to us, but then you think about they are used to having tea with their seafood.
Right.
That has
tannin. Hyper tannic. Teas
right.
in it. Yeah.
So for them, it's a pleasurable experience. It's just not something that we're used to.
Well, our palates are calibrated differently.
That's correct. Anyway, that's a long walk to say that, like, if you like it, fucking do it. But there are certain things that are generally avoided, and that's the reason. So the wine in the glass, I think it's coming across over Mike that I love it. I have drunk a fair bit of it in my time, that I've sold a ton of it. I think it's a good place for a lot of different palates to come together. Some of the most compelling stuff about this wine, I think, is in the story. And that's true of most wines. I love the stories. I love where they come from. I love the people that make these wines. But Elisabetta Foradori is a dominant character in the wine of Trentino Alto Adige and has sort of shaped the conversation around this specific grape, Teraldigo. She inherited the estate after having just completed her enology degree. And that enology degree was gotten in the 1980s when most of those programs were geared towards commercial production. And it became clear to her pretty quickly that that's not what she wanted to do. So she made the first in a series of changes to the estate. That change being replanting using selection Massal.
Go on.
Traditional vine training method in Alto Adige is a training method called pergola, where the vine is trained up a large, high trellis. And this allows for good sun exposure for the grapes. It allows for high yields. It also allows for crops to be planted under the grapes so that you can multipurpose the land. And I do like that part, but that high crop level does tend to lead to lower quality wines.
Mm.
So Elisabetta decided to change the vineyards to Guyot training. If you've ever seen a photograph of a vineyard, most of them are in this fashion. The vine is trained along two wires at either side. And the fruit zone is sort of chest level or just below chest level. And that's where all of the fruit develops. And you have your canopy just above that. It's sort of what the popular conception of a vineyard looks like these days.
So this is what I'm recalling when I think of Star Trek: The Next Generation season 4 episode, where Picard recently, you know, overcoming his assimilation by the Borg, returns home to the family vineyard and gets into a mud wrestling match with his extremely French brother.
That is exactly true. Yes.
For me, when you say this is what a vineyard looks like, my brain,
there it is.
That was my first visual exposure to a vineyard and probably still the overarching one.
I should watch that episode.
Oh, it's so good.
So yeah, that's the idea of a vineyard. So not only did she pull out a lot of old vines that were pergola trained, she planted using selection Massal. In conventional agriculture, when you're replanting a vineyard, you would purchase seedlings from a nursery, and those seedlings would be of a particular clone of the variety that you're looking for. We've talked before about how you don't want to plant from seed because there's a lot of genetic instability,
right,
and you might get a white grape when you want a red grape. Clones are the way that you can be assured that you're going to get what you want.
And then you twist them on there.
They do the grafting. Rootstock, yes.
Right. But she's not trucking with that.
Correct. So she is taking cuttings from already existing vines on the property that are performing particularly well in her eyes and replanting using that. And then each time a plant passes or gets lost during the winter or anytime there's vine death, it'll be replanted from the cuttings of another vine that is performing particularly well in her vineyard.
Hmm.
And this creates sort of a constant adaptation of these plants to the area. And here's where we return to the part in our podcast where Scott gets uncomfortable with the way plants are.
Okay.
So there's a thing called biotypes. And a biotype is when a population of plants that has become genetically differentiated in response to the conditions of a particular habitat. The plants may vary in growth habit, maturity, and other characteristics such as pubescence and flower color, sometimes referred to as geographical race, a locally adapted population within a species which has certain genetically determined characteristics. That's a biotype.
This just sounds like Darwin, right? This sounds like Galapagos Islands and life forms change based on the geographic, like based on their environment.
Yes, but in that scenario, the change is dependent on generational change through sexual reproduction.
Right.
What I'm talking about is actual genetic change that occurs in a single plant based on where it is planted.
So just like Godzilla in the movie.
That's correct.
But you didn't know that ahead of time when you picked this one.
I did not.
These are very nice happy accidents that happen sometimes.
This is not twice in a row.
So, because these plants are genetically superior, just like Godzilla is, they're able to adapt within the lifespan of an organism to new threats and new environmental challenges.
That's correct. Yeah.
So these plants could just become air breathing bipeds and have nuclear purple fire breath.
They could not. No, I mean, I guess it's possible. it's possible.
Many things are possible,
Jamie. It is absolutely insane to me to know that if I were to purchase two Pinot Noir vines from a nursery and plant one here in Pennsylvania and another in California, and then get tests done on them years later after they've reached maturity, they would come back as being genetically different.
But still the same species.
Yes.
But genetically different enough that you can tell. And it's the same organism. We're not talking about generational change.
The best way to think about the distinction between a biotype and a variety is that the species is Vitis vinifera.
Yeah.
That's all of the fine wine grapes. A breed of that species akin to a breed of dogs.
Right. That's what I was going to say. Is this like a dog parallel?
Is the variety.
Yeah.
So like a Jack Russell Terrier and Pinot Noir, right?
Okay.
But then a biotype is like animals don't have the capability to do this, but it's another separation. So like a wire-haired and a smooth coat Jack Russell versus the Pennsylvania Pinot Noir and the California Pinot Noir.
But you said animals can't do this.
Animals can't do this. I'm just trying to illustrate the distinction. The process is unique to plants and it is terrifying.
I mean, yeah, I'm pretty sure I saw an M. Night Shyamalan movie about this and it did not go well for the humans. All right. Yes, I agree. This is strange. Plants are weird. Plants are dirty and funky and getting weird all up in there.
And they're kind of like Godzilla.
And they're a little bit like Shin Godzilla. Not like regular old Godzilla.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about biotypes and selection Massal because I think it's cool, because I think it's really interesting that Elisabetta Foradori was thinking about this in the 80s before a lot of other people were. I think it's cool because it's the first step in the evolution of her estate and her own winemaking, which also, much like Godzilla, has different phases. You know, it went from selection Massal to, you know, she introduced amphora into her winemaking process and then was still kind of not compelled by the wines she was making. And so dove deep into biodynamics and continues to innovate and is still regarded as the queen of Teraldigo. The thing that I didn't anticipate because I hadn't seen the movie was the evolutionary part of all of this.
Right.
I find all of this compelling in a different way.
What do they say in the movie? Something about he has like 10 times the gene pair.
Times the genetics I don't remember what the
DNA
verbiage was.
Is like 100 times more complicated
He's got more DNA.
He's just a superior being.
We have to do origami to figure out his DNA.
Yo, that was cool. When they did the origami folding, that's a great bit of like sci-fi nonsense right there.
That also, by the way, was largely a reason given for the movie being bad in bad reviews on the internet.
It's because they fold the genetic map into origami and that's how they figure it out.
A lot of people were like, origami flip table. So that's what I wanted to talk about this wine, sort of the evolution of the estate. Talk about biotypes a little bit because I think plants are terrifying but cool. And
mostly
also I love seeing your face when you get terrified about them.
Well, it's just that they do things that they're not supposed to do.
I mean, they've been doing them for many, many millions of years.
And I was ignorant about most of it until recently. I got my eye on you, plants. All right.
So, you see, he does not actually have his eye on you, plants.
I have a peace lily upstairs that I keep under close supervision.
Of a peace lily, like Sergeant Angle, Angel in Hot Fuzz.
Yeah, it's a very low maintenance plant, Jamie. I have to remember to water it once a week. It's fine.
It's still alive? You haven't killed it?
No, I haven't killed it yet.
Good job.
And speaking of plants being weird, you know what else is weird about my peace lily?
What?
It's at a point where it has like enough stems and bulbs and stuff that I could just uproot it, split the bulb in half and replant both of them and they're both fine.
Yep. Plants are cool, man.
Plants are weird.
Plants are super cool.
I'm going to cut you in half one of these days and see what happens if something starts growing out of either end.
To the FBI agent listening into this conversation, he is not joking.
Yeah.
Okay, Scott, do you have, what do you got about this?
Well, you said earlier that Teraldigo.
Yes.
Geraldo Rivera.
Geraldo Rivera. That's absolutely correct.
Teraldigo is not a studied grape.
Correct. It has been the subject of study, but it's not.
But
not in the way that Pinot Noir or Cabernet.
It's understudied.
Yes.
is study just a metaphor for people drinking it? Or like, is there an academic wine world that actually studies these things biologically and as plants and then studies the making of them?
All of that. Yeah.
All of that.
The answer, all of that. So, I think it's understudied from a sommelier perspective. People who purchase, drink, sell wine for a living are less inclined to look for examples of Terroir de Go. There also aren't as many out there. Also, a lot less is known scientifically about Terroir de Go than, let's say, Pinot Noir or Chardonnay.
Pinot Noir.
Yes. I pick on Pinot Noir a lot because it's ubiquitous.
It's overstudied.
So yeah, the answer is yes. Like there's not a huge amount of it. And I think that's part of the reason for it. It's only really grown in Trentino Alto Adige. I know of one small vineyard in upstate New York that has some Terroir de Go planted. I think there's a little bit in California, but beyond that, not a lot. But like Alto Adige is not near a viticultural research university. Upstate New York is, Cornell is right there, California is, and UC Davis is right there. And depending on where the plantings are in Australia, they may be. But the plantings are so, there just aren't very many of them in those other places. So it's an underserved variety, I'll say. And part of that is just like the place that it's most famous for, that where it's most planted, is Pinot Grigio territory, where on a massive commercial production scale, a ton of neutral white wine gets made. They're not really concerned with Terroir de Go.
I thought you were a fan of Pinot Gris.
I am.
But you're shit-talking Pinot Gris.
I'm shit-talking commercial Pinot Gris.
Mm.
Which also, by the way, has a place. Like, I'll defend Santa Margarita. It's not a bad wine, but it is big production and lacking in personality.
Yeah, I mean, this has personality.
This has a lot of personality.
Yeah. And then I don't want to go too long on this, but I was asking about things being studied or understudied. And you mentioned that she went to, Elisabetta went to school for enology. And
yes.
You mentioned, so Cornell has like an academic enology program. Is this what I think it is? Is this just like, is academic wine really just like a wine offshoot of agriculture education? Or is it more tied to like cuisine? Like, is it a cooking school offshoot or a farming school offshoot?
Farming school offshoot.
Yeah.
But also plant science school offshoot. Enology is the study of winemaking. Viticulture is the study of vine growing. And then you have plant geneticists and soil scientists and all, like a ton of other supporting disciplines that can specialize into specifically grapevines.
And then there's y'all out there who are just slinging and swilling all day, every day. Would you ever think about going to school for something like that, like going for enology or viticulture?
I don't think so. I don't think it plays to my strengths. You know, I started out going to school for biology largely because I was good at it and I convinced myself that I was passionate about it. And I think part of that was the contrarian in me didn't want to follow in my mother's footsteps and be a creative, but I am more of a creative than I am an analytical mind. And more than that, I'm a performer. I'm someone who likes to be on stage and I'm an extrovert. I get energy from being around people. So it absolutely doesn't play to my strengths. My most recent thought about going back to school was to get an MBA. And that's so that I could better run whatever business I'm a part of as it relates to wine and wine service and the sale of wine, which does play much, much more heavily into my particular skill sets and the things that I love.
Yeah. You know who probably had a bunch of MBAs between them? All those guys who got nuked by Godzilla's purple fire breath in the prime minister's residence.
Yes, that is true.
That is a ineffective bunch of MBAs running around there, getting irradiated and not saving any lives.
I mean, I would not be effective in a Godzilla scenario with or without an MBA, but I feel like I may have a different perspective on running a business with an MBA.
Well, let's focus on you in a Godzilla scenario, because we once again have a very special context-sensitive version of the classic podcast game, Wife Takes.
She's changing it up.
She's having fun. So this game traditionally recreates my wife Tani's favorite way to antagonize Jamie at his restaurants. She would come up with absurdly pretentious and flowery descriptions of the wines he would serve us to mock him and his delicate psalm sensibilities. Today, what we are doing instead is how Jamie faces survival situations in apocalyptic scenarios. So for today, the game is called How Jamie Dies.
This is a great game.
This game feels really good already. So, scenario. Godzilla-type apocalypse. Godzilla is approaching imminently. Buildings are collapsing. You run back into a building to save as many bottles as you can carry. So the scenario, the question is, how does Jamie die? A. Obviously, the building collapses, but you die surrounded by, let's charitably say, hundreds and hundreds of your very favorite wines, so kind of a win for you. B, you make it out with some of the bottles, but you're agonizing about the Sophie's choices you've just had to make, and you're so distracted you get mown down by oncoming traffic. Not all the bottles are broken in the collision, but opportunists take the wine and use it to wash down the canned beans and handfuls of uncooked grain they have for dinner that night, without even pausing to consider if the palate confirms the nose. Your spirit haunts the spot for 15 years out of sheer aggravation.
That was a whole paragraph.
It is literally a paragraph.
Yeah, that was well written, although a little bit hurtful. Yeah. That one felt like a barb.
But you run back in, Jamie. You run back into the building to save the bottles.
What's the next one?
The final solution.
Yeah, don't say that. Nope. Don't say that out loud, but definitely don't cut it from the episode because it's funny.
100% cutting it. The final option for this scenario, option C, you, Jamie, make it to safety and leverage your bottles into a small but influential mercantile empire over the next few years. This is where that MBA is going to pay off. Ultimately, you end up being assassinated. Ultimately, you end up being assassinated by a rival who puts poison in your favorite wine key. Your spirit is annoyed, but acknowledges that you were being kind of a dick and you did sort of have it coming. The rival, feeling hinky about poisoned wine accoutrement, will only drink water from that day on and eventually dies of cholera from a tainted well. So, Jamie, several minutes later, which of these three scenarios do you think you die by?
You don't have to reiterate it.
Well, I'm going to condense. You run back into a collapsing building to save your favorite bottles, but die anyway. You run back in to save some of your favorite bottles, make it out, but then you're killed by oncoming traffic and you proceed to haunt the ingrates and Philistines who don't enjoy the wine the way you would prefer.
Yep.
And C, you leverage your smuggled bottles into a mercantile empire and then are poisoned by a rival.
So B would absolutely not happen. I'm not quite so much of a fucking insane person that if the building is coming down around me, that my Sophie's choice is going to distract me enough that I'm going to get killed in that scenario.
Okay.
My hopeful side is that C is the answer. Also because my rival dies in the end. I do like that a lot more.
You do like that your rival dies in the end?
Yes.
Yeah.
But A is probably most likely because if I'm running back into a building for fucking wine, I probably deserve to die.
Well, yeah. But that doesn't mean that you're going to. Godzilla falls upon the just and unjust alike, Jamie.
Okie dokie.
And then her final thing here is a thought experiment. We have two questions. One, is Godzilla more of a red or a white kind of guy?
Huh.
What do you think? Is Godzilla more of a red or white kind of guy?
For a glass of wine with Godzilla.
That is not what she is suggesting
here. What would I pour him?
Right.
What would he like to be poured? Anyway, I don't think Godzilla's a wine guy.
You don't think Godzilla is a red or a white person?
No.
If Godzilla were to drink a wine, what wine do you think Godzilla would drink?
Godzilla comes from the ocean. There's seafood. White wine goes with seafood. Let's go with that.
All right. So Tani's prediction is, I predict Jamie will say neither, and further predict he will say orange just to be contrary.
Well,
so you did come close to saying neither, but that was really more about you not engaging with the question
right.
than being a contrarian.
That's correct.
So I think she's off base there. And then her other thought experiment question is, which grape varietal or wine style would thrive most in a post-Godzilla environment?
In a post-Godzilla environment.
Right. And we have to talk about the text here. So this is Shin Godzilla, who is, once again, a radioactive monster born this time of, very casually discarded nuclear waste.
I mean, all of the varieties that exist currently, because Godzilla would do didn't well. Make it out of Tokyo, and there no wine is made in Tokyo.
Really? They don't make any wine?
They make wine in Japan.
But not in Tokyo.
Yeah.
Because it's a huge city? Because
it's a metropolis.
I mean, there's like rural areas around Tokyo, but I guess he didn't really rampage through any of them.
Nope.
Well, all right, but assuming Godzilla were to rampage through a agrarian society
my answer is the same
as last time,
because it's dealing with exactly the same issue, which is radiation, and it has to be the most hardy varieties, which are the hybrids.
So you could at least go for like a joke about Godzilla stepping on things and squishing the grapes like the old French ladies do in cartoons.
Wait, she did ask about the style of wine.
Yes.
Not the varietal
or style.
Okay.
So like culturally, maybe what kind of wines start getting made more in a post-Godzilla demolished civilization?
Well, I mean, I think anytime there's great upheaval, people want to drink more. Style is less important, just higher production. So the style would be like neutral juice with alcohol. People just want to get drunk because they just narrowly avoided getting stomped on by Godzilla.
They say he's got to go. Go, go, Godzilla.
Is that a thing?
It's a Blue Oyster Cult song.
Okie dokie.
So that is Wife Takes.
It's an abstract Wife Takes.
Yeah, very, very abstract Wife Takes.
The pairing.
We did pair this wine in this movie.
We did. Scotty here had some things to say about this wine to me. We had a lengthy discussion about
it. I had nothing to say about this wine to you.
You had a lot to say about this movie.
Indeed.
To me.
As I often
and
do.
And we had a lengthy discussion about it. What did you tell me?
Well, I told you that I thought it was an idiosyncratic remix of a pop culture icon. And actually, I forgot to mention this before. Remix is a really important word because even the soundtrack of the movie uses the music cues from Godzilla 1954. It uses the Godzilla march that I think first appeared in one of the late 60s or early 70s movies when he's more of like a hero character. And it includes like the main battle theme from Neon Genesis Evangelion.
Really?
So he's literally remixing different eras of Godzilla and music that is like he is very strongly associated with. Three different themes all pooled together. So like remix, I didn't realize that when I first watched
That's very cool.
Yeah. But so, idiosyncratic remix of a pop culture icon that is tongue-in-cheek without ever winking, that it has a very contemporary worldview. I told you that it was riffing on a sacred cow of Japanese culture, that being the iconic Godzilla, that it is faithful in spirit but not form to its forebears, to the previous Godzilla films from Toho, and that it has a bureaucratic POV and is rooted in deep cultural trauma. What, if anything there, sparked joy for you, Jamie?
It all sparks joy for me, Scott.
Deep cultural trauma sparking joy for you.
I mean, I am Jewish.
when I eventually replace you with a soundboard per friend of the show, Farmer Adam suggested that'll be one of them is I mean, I am Jewish.
I am Jewish. Oh, man.
Okay. All right.
So all right. The things that I was aiming at here, idiosyncratic remix of a pop culture icon, contemporary worldview, and riffing on sacred cow of Japanese culture. Obviously, I'm not talking about Japanese culture in reference to this wine. I'm talking about Italian culture. And that riff is on the grape Teraldego, which is, for the people of the area, iconic. It's a thing that is part of their culture and their heritage. But this is a new lens with which to view it. This is not the traditional pergola training. This isn't old oak aging. This is either stainless steel or amphora. This wine is all stainless steel, but a lot of our other wines are amphora. This is biodynamic agriculture in an area that is typically high yield conventional agriculture. There's a lot being done to give this grape a different perspective, or rather give people a different perspective on this grape. Pop culture icon that I'm talking about is the area of Trentino Alto Adige, which is famous mostly, as I've said, for Pinot Grigio. This is a winery that's focusing almost entirely on Teraldego and not Pinot Grigio in this area where it would be easy just to plant a ton of Pinot Grigio and rake in the money. And as I've said, the way that she does it is different than the way that her neighbors do it. It's idiosyncratic. And the contemporary worldview is the synthesis of all of that. The selection missile, the Guyot training, the biodynamic agriculture, the amphora, the attention to detail, mostly in the vineyard, but then also once the fruit is in the cellar.
I think conceptually, all of that lines up very nicely with this movie.
But in the glass.
In the glass, I'm not feeling much.
I am agnostic about this pairing.
Yeah, I'm not having strong feelings about the wine in general, and especially not about the pairing.
Yeah.
It wasn't really popping for me.
I don't know what type of wine would pair with this movie.
Yeah.
There's so much information flying around in this movie. I almost want a simpler wine.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess you're right. I guess this isn't a simple wine. I am struggling to describe it.
As we've said, you've been struggling with red wines, and that's a common theme. Your refrain of regular old wine smell is...
But this is not regular old wine smell.
I know.
I did not invoke regular old wine smell this time.
I know. And you didn't invoke it last time either.
And that, because that was a different wine.
But what I'm saying is your invocation of that particular word...
It's three words.
Phrase, goddammit.
Wait. Four words. Shit. Cut it all out. Starting over.
It's all bullshit. None of it's real.
None of it's real.
Your invocation of that phrase is not unlike a lot of other sommeliers in training, people like getting into wine for the first time. It can be hard to articulate. Your apparatus isn't broken. It's just the vocabulary will come the more you taste.
But yeah, I think conceptually, like if we want to score just conceptually on a pairing, I think this is pretty successful, especially for the accidental ways that things line up.
And it's fun to talk about the two in tandem. Especially when you talk about plant genetics and then looking at the way Godzilla has biotypes, apparently.
Pretty sweet.
Godzilla is part plant? Question mark?
I mean, it's not the craziest thing in the world.
It's not. What we're beating around here is that conceptually it does work.
Yeah.
In the glass, there's a little bit, I think, too much going on.
Yeah.
I maybe want a white wine, so I'm not dealing with tannin as a structural component. I maybe want something kind of neutral. I don't know. Muscadet always reminds me of the ocean. It's grown near the ocean. It has kind of a sea breeze quality to it, and it's generally kind of simple and enjoyable.
Yeah.
That might be a better pair for this movie. I'd say sake, but like...
That just feels lazy, right?
Well, it's lazy specifically for me because I know so little about sake, and there are so many styles. Like, I've tasted a ton, and I know the breadth that... Or I know some of the breadth of flavor that can be shown... But I like the names for it often like are in one ear and out the other, and the places that it's made, the prefectures and the water sources and the rice varieties. Like there's so much that I don't know about it that for me to just say sake is a cop out at best and culturally insensitive at worst.
Yeah. I mean, when you say it's lazy, what it sounds like is that it's not just that it's a lazy pairing recommendation, but that... You're so lazy, you don't even know how lazy it is. But you're not making that suggestion, so it's okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's fine.
I need to study sake. That was one of my areas of improvement on my Master Sommelier exam.
Sake came up on your Master Sommelier exam? And
it's usually a handful of questions about sake.
Because it's a rice wine?
No, because it there are beer questions and spirit questions.
It's
largely wine, but it's all, like we're supposed to be... The idea of the master sommelier is that you can walk into any restaurant on planet Earth and plug in and run the beverage program.
That's a pretty high bar.
Yes.
That sounds like it was a difficult exam.
I didn't pass.
That doesn't really indicate to me how difficult it is, though. But what you're saying, that you need to just show up and run any beverage program, that sounds like that's pretty hard.
It's tough. Right. Yeah, so sake is a cop-out. I'm not going to suggest it. Muscadet, fair. I think, is my best bet, and I'm going to stick with that.
Muscadet.
Yes.
Definitely a real thing that you didn't make up.
We should drink Muscadet together. I think you'd like Muscadet.
I don't know that I had Muscadet.
It's a simple white wine. It's like classically paired with oysters. It's from the Loire Valley in France.
I like oysters.
Yeah, me too. So, Scotty, we've watched Shin Godzilla. I'm going to ask you about a double feature.
You're going to ask me about a double feature.
The last double feature you gave me
was
Dr. Strangelove to this movie.
Right. Therefore, I must recommend that people watch Dr. Strangelove now. No. I have been thinking about this, and while it is from a tonal and genre standpoint, a complete departure, I think talking about like idiosyncratic remixes of pop culture icons. The only thing I can think about is a constant favorite on rotation in this household, which is the Lego Batman movie, which, just like this movie, takes a pop icon and, in a very 21st century worldview, takes the whole history of the character and everything about it and remixes it into something that is both the recognizable, like, iconic version of the character, but that also includes all of the other iterations and derivations and deviations of the character over time. So, like, your Lego Batman movie it's the same Batman from the Lego movie. So it's Will Arnett playing, like, the most brilliant spin on the character ever, which is, like, sure, he's, like, a brilliant detective and a great martial artist and is super smart, but, like, what if he's also kind of a moron? You know, like, smart people can be morons.
Yep.
Well, it takes that, like, dark, gritty, I'm Batman, no one has any good ideas except Batman, like, that character, but surrounds him with, like, the colorful history and legacy of all of the other iterations of Batman and incorporates them canonically. Like, canonically, the Lego Batman has been Batman for 80 plus years in the story of the movie.
That's
and
awesome.
He went through his Adam West phase, and he went through his, like, Michael Keaton and Val Kilmer phase. And they reference all of that and they bring it all together, but still understanding fundamentally what works about it and why. And of the 800 Batman movies that have come out in the last few years, seemingly, it is the only one that has gone back to the earliest days and took the second most major addition to the Batman canon and incorporated it in a fresh new way, which is this movie has a Robin.
Right.
And does great and wonderful and thoughtful and clever things with that character that's faithful but still new. So, yeah, are they the same? No. Is the Lego Batman movie the funniest fucking movie? Yes, and I love it, and I think people should watch it. And at some point, we'll talk about it on the show.
Cool, cool. My second glass for this wine, I mentioned that there is a vineyard of Teraldigo in upstate New York. It should come as no surprise to anyone that I'm still talking about Finger Lakes wine. So Red Tail Ridge, Teraldigo, from the west side of Seneca Lake. Nancy Ireland is the owner and winemaker. I think of her she has a very different story from Elisabetta Foradori, but they're both sort of singular in their worldview and uncompromising in their winemaking. And I love Nancy's wines, from her, like, simple, easygoing Riesling and Chardonnay to her crazy sparkling wine program. And then also she makes this, like, dark, inky, full-bodied, tannic Teraldigo that is more aggressive than this one, a little bit more earthy. It's a really good way to start to understand what this grape tastes like. Red Tail Ridge, Teraldigo.
Teraldigo.
Teraldigo. Hey, and it is available at redtailridge.com.
People on Vivino also made the jokes about how it's difficult to pronounce.
I don't think it is. Teraldigo.
Teraldigo.
You got it. Good job.
Teraldigo.
A round of applause, everyone.
I did it. I said Teraldigo.
Next time on.
Next time on. Well, we are continuing. It's the end of the world as we know it, and I desperately
need. And I want wine.
Oh my God, I brought this on myself. This is entirely my fault. I'm very sorry, everyone. Well, we are continuing with yet another flavor of world-ending, apocalyptic, humanity-obliterating scenarios, and we are, of course, talking about the Machine Uprising. We are more closely approaching things that I think are actual plausible threats to humanity. So we are talking about the fucking all-time masterpiece, 1999's The Matrix, written and directed by the Wachowskis. I don't need to tell you anything about The Matrix. It's The Matrix. It's one of the most important movies ever in the medium. It is one of the most influential pieces of pop culture ever in the history of pop culture. It rules. I cannot wait to rewatch it again. I cannot wait for The Matrix Resurrections. We will try to talk about that while we have our Matrix discussion, but no promises. It might get crowded out. And spoilers for our discussion, the thing that I'm most terrified of The Matrix isn't the robots enslaving all of us.
Oh boy.
Yep.
I love that. Yeah, that's not a spoiler. That was foreshadowing.
I mean, I guess, unless they didn't want to be spoiled. Some people think spoilers are different than you do, Jamie. Some people think foreshadowing is spoilers.
Interesting.
Which it kind of is.
I guess it kind of is.
Yeah. So, Jamie, I told you The Matrix. You, after you finished squeeing because you got to talk about a movie that's great, said, hey, we should drink some wine, too.
We should drink some wine too. I'm super excited about The Matrix. So, wine people, I'm sorry if you're about to be triggered by what I'm going to say. I'm pairing The Matrix with Cloudy Bay Sauvignon Blanc 2020.
Jamie, somebody just kicked down my front door. Wine people are enraged. You've triggered them all. What did you do?
I don't care what anybody says. Cloudy Bay is one of the most important, tectonic, influential wines of the 20th century. It changed the conversation around the grape and around New Zealand and continues to be great wine. There's more to say. We will say it on the episode.
And then some.
I think it's very, very good. I think it gets a bad rap. I think its ubiquity is mostly the bad rap that it gets. Also, it might be a little bit too expensive, but that's market forces. This is available at wine.com for $36.
$36. And The Matrix, as of this recording, is available for your streaming pleasures on HBO Max. I got that brand new 4K. It's just waiting for me. It's just waiting up there. I'm so excited.
We are very excited for this episode. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. Please follow us on the socials at Bigger Bottle Pod. Email us with any questions or concerns at biggerbottlepod@gmail.com. Make sure you rate, review, and follow the show. Tell your friends about us, please.
Tell them more about me than you tell them about Jamie. But most importantly, tell them about the show. Not just about us. Tell them about the show.
Don't tell them about us. Just tell them about the show.
All right. Well, you told them to tell them about us.
It's true. They don't need to know about us.
Right. They'll find out soon enough.
Yes.
Well, this episode, as many others were, was produced and edited by me, Scott Hudson, and our social media presence is the work of him, Jamie Harrison Rubin, right over yonder.
Remember, everyone, drink more wine, watch more movies. It's good for you. We promise.
Good night, everyone. Goodbye.
Goodbye.